Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to After Things, the show that comes after Weird Things. I'm Andrew Main. I'm joined by Justin Robert Young.
Well, hello, friends.
Brian Brushwood.
Howdy, howdy.
And our totally not mediocre producer, Bryce Castillo.
That doesn't have the same ring, does
that's loaded.
It? Super, that's loaded. Super producer extraordinaire.
Totally not mediocre.
I mean, technically they're the same thing, right?
But one an of them hour just ago, rings. I was Mr. Awesome.
Well,
doesn't in a Venn diagram of Mr. Awesome and totally not mediocre, it like intersects.
Yeah, I was about to say, Mr. Awesome is most certainly not mediocre,
you know,
it's the same thing.
It's the totally that is.
Well, I mean, would you like to be partially not mediocre or totally not mediocre?
Just not mediocre. Hi, everybody.
Yeah.
He's in his bubble.
I'm rethinking that intro, Bryce. Not in the way that you hope.
I would say that between the four of us here, we all read a lot, you know, in varying amounts. I would say that probably Brian and Justin probably read the most. I don't know who reads more between the two of them, but I know you guys... On your choo-choo train of books.
They love their Audible.
It goes around the classroom.
Yeah.
I don't totally follow that metaphor, but I'm all aboard.
Didn't you, when you're a kid, like in the classroom and you read a book, did you ever do the train thing? Each time you read a book, you got like a little caboose or a little train car on your train.
Oh. That doesn't feel like a universal experience, Andrew.
Not what? I mean, no, Andrew.
Well,
we
maybe
all
we should
remember
start that,
when that happened,
I'm
right?
Start building choo-choo trains for you right now on the wall.
When the choo-choo train got very large because we all read a lot of books.
All read a lot of books.
Check it, check it, check it, check it, check it, check it.
All right, anyhow, my point is.
Throw another book in the furnace. This choo-choo train's going fast.
The train runs on books.
Fahrenheit 450 train.
How did they measure how many books you read when you were a kid in class? Did they care?
We had
yeah, I don't know,
Star.
Man.
I don't know if we had, it was like a quizzing program. So like if you read a book, you'd go on the computer and you would do the Star test to make sure you read the book. And if you read it, you would get points that you could use at the Scholastic Book Fair.
Oh yeah, I think there was something like that. I was never a great reader as a student though, so maybe I've blocked out this whatever system was in place for me. I've blocked out most of my reading. Came as I got a little older in life. Most of my elementary school reading was all just checking out the same four compilations that Marvel made with origin stories for various superheroes. I would just continue. I just check them out and read them over and over and over and over.
I remember being in ninth grade, and our English teacher had a policy where for every book you read, you didn't have to do a report or anything. Like you just had to credibly say, I read this book, and then, you know, have a conversation enough to, you know, believe you. Yeah. And then you got one point added to your grade, full stop.
Oh.
And I jokingly said, hey, so comic books count? And then, and to my surprise, and this is an elderly woman, you know, who had been there forever. And she was just like, you know what? There's some really good comic books out there. I'm going to say yes. And this,
issues or trades?
Well, I'm sure she meant it as graphic novels or trades or, you know, I mean, certainly, I mean, if you read all of Watchmen, then you deserve, you know, the credit for having read a book.
Yeah.
It was great. Like, and then I pressed her on it. And this is like first day of class. I'm like, wait, so if I just read 90 books over the semester, then I don't have to take a single test. And she was like, no, you don't. Because if you read 90 Jeez. Books,
I mean, you have to go to class.
I'm going
to
say,
I'm sure. Is like,
well, oh, sure, sure. Yeah. I mean, you have to be there, but you could just tune out and read 90 books.
Man,
and it turns out that I think
that's
she
why
was
they,
right.
I think that's why they changed this to the Scholastic points instead of,
yeah.
instead of that.
I was at Reason Magazine, Reason.org, had their 50th anniversary gala this weekend in Los Angeles. which if you ever read Reason, I highly recommend it. Reason is, of course, you know, they have their own philosophical and political point of view on stuff. But I would say that they're fun. They're interesting. They have really neat takes on stuff. And, you know, it's worth I'm one of these people think you should read every source that you can. You have time for and kind of I just sort of settled into them because I really like their coverage. I really like the way they handled stuff. So they had their 50th anniversary gala. And it was very, very neat because they had some of the people there from the beginning of Reason and helping, you know, shape this organization. And the keynote was from Mitch Daniels, the former governor of Indiana, very interesting guy. And one of the things he talked about was the five books that influenced him the most. And that was, you know, more attuned to that audience. But I thought, you know, that's a neat topic to talk about books that influenced us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the original people behind Reason, Frank Poole, who used to put the magazine together, talked about how that magazine working on that. You know, he found himself talking to Robert Heinlein in the 1970s, and Robert Heinlein had every single issue they had ever put out.
Oh,
you
wow.
know, and his wife was like, you know, he doesn't save anything, you know. And you know, Frank was like, this is such a, you know, flattering sort of thing to have this iconic kind of person who's loved what you've done and saved it and whatnot. And you talk about influences, and I think, like, well, you know, Heinlein was an influence on me, you know. And so I want to talk about books that influenced us.
Ooh, man, wow. I'm looking at the guest list. And I'm so upset that I didn't hop on a plane and I thought we were close
40
enough friends.
40 minutes ago, you were saying you were not traveling.
I know, but I would have made an exception for this because, like, Virginia Postrel she wrote. You attended one of the Wizard Academy classes where we talked about her book on glamour and praying.
Brian, you know what this is.
What?
Well, Andrew was all upset that he didn't get invited to Vegas. We were all telling fun Vegas stories. Next thing you know, look who's riding on without his weird things, pals, to the Reason event.
Michael Shermer once told me my magic show was better than Copperfield's, and I don't think he meant it. He softened it.
I saw Michael there, by the way.
I know you did. I'm sure it was great.
Oh, Michael.
I'm sure it was great.
Oh, just me and Mike hanging out.
You and my Mike. That's fine. It's great. I'm real thrilled for you. Loved Ron Bailey's book, Rise of the Warrior Cop. It's fine. Okay. It's fine that
books
they were all there.
Books that influenced you, Brian.
I literally have a list of things to do before I die, and Meet John Stossel is on that list. It's fine that John Stossel was at this party.
He was on the list.
It's fine.
Well, I asked Nick Gillespie, I said, if this were Scientology, who would be your Tom Cruise, John Stossel or Drew Carey?
You're killing me. You're killing me. A lot of say
Mitch
that
Daniels.
Brian would have loved to have been at the Reason.
By the way, Brian, Mitch Daniels, in one of his five books, mentioned Virginia Postrel's, I think it was The Future and Its Enemies.
Oh, no kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, that's awesome. I think it's The Power of Glamour. I don't know if I'm getting that right. Virginia Postrel's book is really, really good in that there is great artistic power in withholding things. The Power of Glamour is her book. For example, even the cover is an example of it because you can see it's a beautiful woman, but her face is turned away, and in doing so, by withholding the all I want to see is her face, and that's one of the artistic things over at the Wizard Academy they talk a lot about.
So that's one of your most influential books.
It's sort of baked into the DNA of a lot of what they teach over at Wizard Academy. Mm-hmm. And she was last year's, so they just did the reunion. She was last year's guest of honor and did a whole presentation. And then I didn't even know that, like, I only knew her work from Wizard Academy, but then somebody said, she's like an OG, she's Reason royalty. And I was like, oh my God.
Oh, yeah.
And so getting to chat with her was a lot of fun.
Yeah, she's a great intellectual who you don't hear talked enough about, in my opinion, in her thoughts. And just the number of people who cite her is just how her concise way of looking at things, breaking it down, just brilliant. So any other suggestions, any books, things that influenced you?
I just want to talk about this party. How great was this party?
Is it a good party, though? Like, was it a fun party? Did everybody have a good
You know, so the evening part was it was black tie or 60s yeah. attire. So I, of course, went out and got myself like a corduroy shirt, 60s like velour, whatever tuxedo top, and then like a big scarf. You know, I looked like, you know, a 60s porn producer.
A Richard Dawson was always rocking the cravat that later became the inspiration for Austin Powers.
Yeah. So, like, I don't know that I'm not a big lobster tail fan. It was pretty good, but I got to say the short rib was fantastic. The short rib was great.
It's fine. We're going to have our own reason party with Blackjack and Hookers.
I know. It's just going to be me doing the John Stossel impression with Brian alone.
And when you see me weeping, it'll be the tears of joy because I'm finally at the better party than the one you went to.
I know. I know. We're going to have a mop stood up and we're going to call her Catherine Mangu Ward.
She was there. She says hi.
I know. Son of a bee.
You're killing me. I actually didn't talk to Catherine. I was
Kat couldn't get FaceTime.
One more note, just about Reason. I've always been in love with Reason's tone and style. I think that they, Matt Welch, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward are some of my favorite political kind of writers that have always understood that you need a kind of style that doesn't necessarily have to totally incinerate your substance, and that it can be flexible and adherent to different ideas. So go give Reason. Don't be like, oh, it's the libertarian thing. Just read the Hit and Run blog. The Hit and Run blog is a great little way to get into that idea of like, oh, look, here's this way of thinking.
What I love about the Hit and Run and also the think pieces are very libertarian-y, but specifically the as a matter of fact, like they just did a video. Is this Gary Johnson's last campaign? He's running as a third party for I think a House seat.
He actually had a video they sent. He couldn't be there because he's campaigning, but we actually had a video from him saying,
"You're killing me." It's great to hear the voice of somebody who doesn't really have a dog in most fights and can. Who's very aware of all the political maneuvering, but also, is looking for an outsider perspective. And I don't know, it seems healthy. I think whether you're right, you're on the right or on the left, I think it's worth listening, to outsider voices.
What I appreciate, and it's not like I straight took like, yes, this is right. This is right. I wrote an email to Ronald, because he had an article a week ago that I said, like, I took issue with. I said that I think you made a logical error here. Whatever. Talked to me. He's like, no, you're right on that point. But the bigger point, I'm like, well, I'm not going to tell you you're wrong. And really, they're super accommodating. And you could show up there and say, hey, I'm diametrically opposed to everything you guys think or feel. And they're like, great, let's sit down. Let's have a drink and talk. You will be welcomed. You will be welcomed by these people, and they'll say, "Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the history." Because the ones that the people involved in Reason, they know every side. They've read every side of it. They read. I've gone to these little mini conferences where we sit around reading 19th century socialist literature, just so you understand. Those the evolution of that, so you understand. Not like ha ha ha. Look at this. It's like, well, this is the argument they're making. This is what they're trying to address. So, I would say the intellectual honesty there is wonderful.
Yeah.
And there's just a curiosity. I think that's the thing that I've always really enjoyed about them is that they have always, to me, had a commitment. And whenever I've been able to see their events, I mean, not this one, obviously, because I wasn't invited. But in general, for Reason events, there's always, a thought of like, okay, well, let's not if the point of view of the entire brand is our ideas have kind of been locked out of the mainstream, then that kind of curiosity sort of bubbles over, I think, into a lot of stuff. It's like, all right, is there another way that we're not thinking about this? Or is there something that we can unite everybody on because nobody would look at this and say that this is not ridiculous. One of my favorite things, I think it was in a Reason magazine. It was like a back page cartoon. It was a visual illustration of all the steps that you would need to take to fire a teacher in New York City. And that is if, like, you find, like, hit, like, your teacher removes their mask, it's literal Hitler. Hitler's there. You need to get Hitler out. Stop Hitler from teaching your children immediately. And it was the entire back page of, well, first you need to report it. And then you have to have the mandatory 2-month waiting period, and then you have to have the hearing. But the hearing can be delayed as per the union bargaining agreement.
And then you must drown the squirrel. If the squirrel drowns, congratulations. It's a hypothesis. Now we must ask a three-eyed goat for to tap 9 times.
But it's one of those things that I think is indicative of why I very much enjoy Reason, is because it's like, look, this isn't unions are bad. This isn't these school districts are the way to go. It wasn't even, although they do oftentimes land on the side of school choice. This isn't we need to remove all of your kids from public schools immediately. It was, can't we all agree that this is gratuitous? let's just point out that this is something that could be done better. We can do a better job with this. And that's what I've always appreciated about their thinking. That and that one time that I heard Ron Bailey talk, and he was like, oh no, we should probably start thinking about solving climate change with gigantic reflective satellites that can affect how many UV rays. And it's like, it's just one of those thoughts where to me, I'm like, man, why isn't anybody else talking about stuff like this? I'm like, why are we worrying about, you know, how many plastic bags I get to take out of the Whole Foods instead of like, no, what? Give me more on this reflective satellites thing.
One of the things they've been involved with in trying to be kind of like stepping aside from the politics is, you know, one of the problems we have is we have a public pension crisis facing us. And that is that every city, state, whatever, you have employees, and in part of your, you know, you have these pensions these people are, you know, contractually promised to get. You go work for the government because, you know, you're supposed to be getting paid a thing. And these are massively underfunded. You know, there's like, you know, like something probably like $1 trillion+ or more deficit that they don't have in there. They should have in there now. And there's going to be a big crisis as you have an aging population and there's just not the money to pay for them. And you don't want to have situations like, I think it was San Bernardino or places where you tell people, hey, we're not going to give you what we promised, you know? And so Reason has actually worked with some cities and stuff to say, let's help you solve this problem now. Let's help you figure out how to make sure that your employees, the people there that are promised they're going to be taken care of, how do we restructure this sort of stuff? Because, you know, you get people, every election's great. Elections are wonderful, but you put a bunch of new people in there who don't understand the problem and who won't be around in 10 years when it starts to bite you in the butt, who make short-term decisions. And we've had California with CalPERS, like you had, you know, 9 people cost a $1 trillion deficit because they pegged basically the bonus structure to like the booming stock market, you know, which was dumb. But to their credit, like they're well-intentioned people. They didn't know any better, but they only spent like 20 minutes listening to a counter argument why to do it. And now here we are, like a $1 trillion deficit because it seemed like a good idea at the time. And that those things far out anything you think that we lost because of Wall Street, you know, shenanigans, which is a lot.
Yeah.
You put that on a municipal and state level and it just far out does it. So Reason's trying to work with like, hey, how do we make these, how do we stop this problem? It's not a political point of view. It's not saying one side's right or wrong. It's like, we've got economists, we've got people who understand how to structure these things. We've looked at all these other cities that had these problems. And now we think we have, maybe we can help you here prevent this.
And that is, I think, a general thing that I've always appreciated about Reason is that they tend to look at government not as this like, oh, this thing we need to rail against per se, but just one option in many that we can look at. And I think that's like probably their only, to me, their only like religious thesis is like, let's just consider all options. Can we not start the conversation by fundamentally eliminating 90% of the board and only getting to argue about these two things? Let's, for the sake of intellectual discourse and also, I don't know, the future of our nation and the world, just bandy about these other different ideas that maybe don't fit the orthodoxy of one side or the other.
Yeah. So we live in an age where part of the problem is that no matter what party comes to power, when you're in office, the way the most power you have is the power to spend.
Yeah.
And even if you come in there with like, well, I'm going to cut spending, but I'm going to spend it over here though, you know, or I'm going to do this. And that's the challenge we face is that, you know, we're, you know, in any level, you know, you, 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 it's hard to get elected saying we need to tighten our belts when people want you to loosen them. And, you know, and it's hard to say, you know, we're going to cut this program to pay for this other program. You know, nobody wants to hear that. And but anyhow, influential books. You know, one of the things that got me thinking was Robert Heinlein had this interesting evolution where he kind of started off as almost maybe borderline fascist. You read Starship Troopers, whatever, you know, enlistment gives you citizenship, et cetera. And then he evolved. His thinking really evolved from the 40s to the 50s to the 60s. Then you read, the 60s, the Michael Valentine Smith. What's the name of this? I'm just totally.
While you look that up, I do think it's fascinating that I read bits of the book Starship Troopers, but I only know it by the parody of the idea of. Enlistment guarantees citizenship and all that stuff. Like, Starship Troopers, the movie, is some of the best satire I've ever seen in my entire life. And I think it's satirizing the book Starship Troopers. It's amazing in that regard.
Stranger in a Strange Land. I can't even believe that just escaped me.
Yes, of course.
Did you have a problem grokking it?
I grokked it, man. This is a book that came out, 1961, and just was sort of at the start of, this big, cultural revolution. And, here's, Heinlein, the guy that wrote, Justin and I had a teacher, Mr. Wilkner, who, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful teacher, but I would say his political leanings were very different from my own. And I remember I'm sitting in class and I just found out that Robert Heinlein died, and his class was next to ours. He's walking through and I look up and I go, Robert Heinlein died. And he goes, good. He was a fascist and just exited through the door.
Wait, did he not read Stranger in a Strange Land? Wow.
He's Mr. Wagner. He was, he was a very kind, soul, but he was a very blunt human.
Yeah. So I remember that. And I don't think that's right. I think you're saying that to get a reaction, but what a horrible thing to say to a kid whose hero just died, but he would go on and on about, people who I think are completely, well, Neil Postman's latest thing. It's like, oh, please. So one of the things that, that I really loved was that through Heinlein, first I get into this sort of rugged individualism, which I kind of like, but also through his sort of expression that it means respecting the rights of others to be very, very different from yourself or whatever. And so I was the first time, when I was a kid, you hear gay people, someone might be gay, they're gay or this or whatever. And you're like, well, that's just different and weird or whatever. And then you read Heinlein where it's sort of like, some people are this, some people aren't. Why do you care? And it's that, why do you care? I'm like, oh yeah, I guess that makes sense.
It is. I remember reading, Pierce Anthony wrote a lot of books, and some of them were good. I definitely loved On a Pale Horse and the Incarnations of Immortality series. He had another one, the Adept series. And there's this moment when somebody is like it's a world where you have a person who falls in love with a robot, and then also a magical being that could transform into a unicorn or be a human, and they're falling in, various combinations of falling in love with each other, and there's that moment you're like, you're okay with this robot being in love with and making love to a horse with a unicorn horn, but it's like, but you're gonna think, that this lifestyle that exists in reality is weird. And it's like, oh my God, yeah, it was one of those eye-opening moments for me as well.
Yeah, like in Heinlein, you're reading about, a guy who's lived, longest lived man in the world, and then what's he gonna do next? Like, why not live as a woman?
Yeah.
And then you're like, interesting. You're like, yeah. And then you kind of get like, wait, all of a sudden I've just been presented this sort of idea of, transgenderism, the idea of understanding it from the internal point of view. If you said, hey, read a book about, somebody deciding to switch genders or whatever, I'd be like, think you knew, but then you read it from this point of view and you're like, oh, interesting. I see the point here. Well,
this sort of speaks to, and in fact, I think we're going to recall you guys back right now, but it does speak to me about the role as prognosticators and predictors of the future that the great scientific, the great science fiction writers have adopted over the years. The idea of oracles of things to come, especially as so many of the things we read in science fiction turns out to be exactly right down the road. I mean, you know, I remember reading Ender's Game, and here I live in the internet world where, you know, all that sounded like crazy talk. The idea that the family would gather around with everybody reading their virtual up to the minute personalized newspapers, following whatever medium posts they are super excited about.
It is interesting because you get people who really think about these things deeply, and they sort of see these sort of, you know, trends to where they're going to be, and you kind of go, wow, you know, and sometimes the future happens different ways. But so I liked Heinlein for that approach. I would say a book that I don't know if I recommend it, but man, did it affect me, was Maxwell Maltz's Psycho-Cybernetics. Maxwell Maltz was the physician who learned plastic surgery like after World War I or World War II, and started finding out that you take somebody who had, you know, a woman who had, you know, maybe a funny look nose, he'd fix her nose, and all of a sudden her self-esteem would change dramatically and she'd become a very positive, outgoing person. Or somebody was a very attractive person who complained about some feature, he could fix that feature, but then they'd come back 6 months later with something else that they felt bad about. And he realized how much our external idea of how we appear affects our personality, our behavior, whatever. And I would say one of the that book helped me a lot with my own self-esteem. You know, reading as a young man, reading that book and trying to separating my personal, you know, my thoughts of my personal appearance or whatever from my inner point of view of who I was. You know, the time I was a kid, I wore glasses. I had this chin quiver that quivered a lot and whatnot. And so, you know, I was very, very, you know, insecure because of these things. And that was a book that made me think about things in a different way. And also, I think he got into a lot of, like, you know, there's also sort of like, you know, take ownership for yourself, like stop blaming other people, looking for external things. And that's a problem now, is because, you know, there's an ideology out there that, you know, like it says, hey, problems because of everybody else. And often, like, yeah, you know, people deal with adversities and stuff. These things are real. But if you tell people the only solution is get rid of the adversity at some point and then you'll be fine, that'll never work.
Yeah, that's a wild one. I remember seeing Psycho-Cybernetics on the bookshelf of my parents' library, as it was. And all of a sudden, I feel bad that it's a book that they've read and I haven't. And I guess that one will be next on the list if there's an audiobook.
I don't know how well it holds up at all. I really don't know. I remember at the time with some of these things that I read that I'm like, you know, this made an impact. And I had a discussion with a friend of mine once about, he went to one of the Werner Erhard seminars, EST, which is, you know, it's controversial self-help or large group awareness things where, you know, they kind of, you go inside there for 3 days and, you know, then they make you heavily recruit other people. So it's sketchy as all hell. And my friend said, yeah, I went to one. So it's great. Made me, he said, you know, the realization I had would seem trivial to you, but for him, it was basically, take responsibility for, forgive everybody, take responsibility for your own actions and just move on. And that's just, it's a powerful sort of thing. You know, we can live in perpetual sense, perceiving ourselves as victims, but then you never move on.
So, man, it's interesting because you've picked an interesting vector, because a lot of the formative books I read when I was young were all fiction, specifically, I guess fantasy and science fiction. And it's interesting how many ideas percolate down through that modality that have a profound impact. And it's like, I would never read a nonfiction book when I was, you know, 16, 17 years old. And yet a bunch of the important ideas that was being bandied about in nonfiction books show up in there.
I got a fiction book that I was really not a gigantic reader when I was a kid. And even growing up, like, I was so much more of a news hound. Like, I was obsessive about newspapers and magazines and stuff like that. But I wasn't really a tremendous book reader. The one book I will say that has stuck with me probably more than any other is the Watchmen, which is now a graphic novel, was a comic series. Just the lesson, the moral of that story, specifically Adrian Veidt and Dr. Manhattan told me more about my own anxiety, about my how much the world is uncontrollable, how much, you know, even this obviously this is an outsized mythic tale of superheroes, but, you know, spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't listened to the or hasn't read The Watchmen, Adrian Veidt has a plan to save the world, and does. And in his moment, he knows that there's only one person on the planet that he can look in the eye and have tell him that he saved the world. And the answer that Dr. Manhattan has for Adrian Veidt is that, you know, nothing ends, nothing ever ends. And the idea that, like, okay, best laid plans in all the moral compromises that could go behind it, right? This is a story about how the you know, on however you want to see it, either this was the greatest, most heroic act in the history of the planet on a long enough timeline, only for him to realize in the final moment that he wasn't looking at a long enough timeline, right? And him, you know, the questions and the thoughts that you grapple with that, and then take that as the micro of, like, how much do we care about the plans that we make and the moral compromises that we make? And what if we now think about that on an infinite timeline? What if we now think about that as it's not about what it's going to be for tomorrow, what it's going to be for next month, what it's going to be for next year, what it's going to be for the next 10 years. But what if you think about it as, no, I'm making these decisions in infinite space, and now they have to stand up infinitely. It made me think so much more about my own personal, how I process things and how I want to behave than really any other book that I've ever read.
Yeah, I guess this is where I just make a confession. I've probably read 35 to 40 Pierce Anthony books. That's how I spent pretty much 8th grade through 10th grade. Maybe 7th grade. Starting with On a Pale Horse and going from there. Some of his stuff was weird, and I don't know that I'm a better person for having read it. like he explores in this book Firefly, he explores, like, this guy's in jail and his only crime is being sexually attracted to young children, and like that's some weird ass shit to read in your sophomore year of college from somebody you've been reading for 4 years, and right. I'm just like, all right,
what did I sign up for here?
Yeah, exactly, right. However, I will say the Incarnations of Immortality series was just such a blast. The idea that there are not quite gods, somewhere in between gods and humans, are folks like death, fate, time, war, and then lesser beings like, you know, famine, the four horsemen, and so on. And then ultimately the series rounds out with God and the devil, and all of them represented as offices that you take up. So in the case of On a Pale Horse, it's a world where, you know, both magic and technology exist. You might have a digital watch, or you might have a magical sundial on your wrist. And also it just feels late 70s as hell. It's amazing. And dude decides he's going to kill himself, and in walks death. And in a snap reaction, he fires a shot between the eyes of death, and death dies. And in walks, hi, I'm Fate. I sort of knew this part was coming. I'm here to tell you that you've killed death, and guess what? You now are assume the office. And he takes off, you know, and death turns out to be a mortal immortal, a person who wears magical technology. And so it's like, here, put on this cloak, and oh, look, now you look like you have a crazy skull face. Take this, here's a switchblade scythe. Here's your horse that is, you press a button and it turns into a Corvette. It's insane and awesome. And then, you know, the next book is about time. And it's like, you're at the right place at the right time. So the good news is you're now Kronos. You could go anywhere. But the bad news is you are 42 years old. You will live exactly 42 more years, and then you will die. And then, because you will live, also you're going to live backwards. So everything you remember is stuff that hasn't happened to everybody you encounter. It's a real trip. It's a real trip. It was a fun series. Got a little sloppy at the end, but I liked it.
You know,
in the parable story, we've mentioned this before, probably several times, but I think it's worth mentioning again. Richest Man of Babylon.
Oh, most important book I've read. I mean, life changing, literally life changing. And I feel like we've hammered on that a lot, though.
I agree, but there's always new people too here, and just there's the person going, ah, but really, it's a. You know, and I'll say this again, the lesson they talk about the parable of throwing the stone from the bridge is just, you know, just the idea of like how we it's a wonderful lesson that we've now learned later on in, you know, human psychology and what forms patterns and behavior and whatnot. And the idea is that if you commit yourself to do a thing, basically do the thing. Don't make excuses. You know, don't say, well, I'll do twice the effort tomorrow. I'll do this or whatever. I'll make up for it. You won't. You know, just understanding the power of commitment. And that was. Trying to think of one of the other books. It was what is the greatest sales? What was it? Trying to think of another one that there was another. I'll get to the point.
The Greatest Secret from Earl Nightingale.
No, not that. Let me look this up.
But in the meantime, I'll mention one of the beauties of The Richest Man of Babylon is that it's not about. Nowadays, you buy a book on finance, you're going to get a lot of specifics that are relevant to early 21st century, late 20th century, or whatever. The fact that it's set in ancient Babylon, and it's up to you to figure out the meaning of the parable, where we're speaking in the simple language of, if I earn 10 gold coins a day, and every day I put 10 gold coins into a bucket, and only remove 9 by the end of the day, what happens in a month? Oh, I'm overflowing with gold coins. Like, you know, you get the message without needing to get bogged down in any of the specifics.
Yeah. I think maybe it was Think and Grow Rich, Napoleon Hill, that got into, you know, like the willpower, you know, just the idea of willpower, what that really means. And there's sort of, it alludes to this, dances around what the point is. And then you kind of realize like, oh, these people who succeeded or whatever, you know, there's a story in there, like, I think it was like the little girl trying to tell, you know, her mom's employer, like, you've got to, you know, you owe her like $4. He's like, I'm not going to give it to you. And then she finally got the $4. And it's like, why did she? Her resolve was greater than his. And that's a critical thing. You know, how do you succeed? If your resolve is greater than the people around you, that's where you succeed.
Yeah, agreed. So how does it work with picks when all we're doing is giving picks?
I think we just say, just rewind, suckers.
I would say we just go for one. Pick the one if you said, hey, is the thing that I think could have the most impact.
If you've not seen it, go watch Gattaca. And I think it's timeless. I think it stands up.
Marge, this isn't Gattaca.
Gattaca had a very important message, and I've quoted it several times in other contexts, but if you don't know what I'm talking about, then watch that movie. It's a great study in as you were just referring to Stoicism, and do the thing, you know, one pebble every day, and you see an example of that where despite tremendous global adversity, somebody does the impossible, and I liked it a lot.
Cool. Justin?
I would Watchmen to me is just such a great if you have not read it, it's worth reading. If you've only seen the movie, it's worth reading. If you're excited about the HBO series that's coming up, it's worth reading. There's a lot there. Not all of it is you know, a lot. There's certainly plenty of thrills and chills that are not necessarily the moment or the effect that it had on me when I first read it. But, other than that, I don't know, about fiction that makes you think about kind of life. I would also say a Foundation to me was another one where the idea of, I mean, the initial premise of like, the science of predictive history and the gigantic scope that story tells, and specifically, you know, probably the great developed into television or movie villain is the mule and what the mule represents in that story. Just this gets back to expectation versus versus execution, and how much knowing what the future is helpful or not. And if you know what the future is, then does that mean that you change it or you don't?
So, you know, Apple is making the Foundation TV series.
Yeah, and I'm pumped. I'm excited for it. I think that it's a very interesting property to make, because those books tend to span like hundreds of years, right? Like in between and
thousands, yeah.
Thousands. I mean, and even in the books themselves, you are just jumping kind of relentlessly forward in time, no matter how much you care about the characters, which is sort of its charm. But I would wonder whether or not they just stop and linger on some of the more seminal stories that are told in that series.
You know that one of the things that was in Elon Musk's Tesla Roadster, which is now past the orbit of Mars, was a disc, memory disc, with the Foundation books.
Oh, that's great.
Awesome.
So I think that's great. Great pick. There's like Foundation, and then actually Player of Games, I joke, is sort of like kind of like a nerd catcher in the rye.
Yeah.
You know, you'll hear certain people mention like Player of Games. You're like, yeah, I know.
I liked it quite a bit. I couldn't describe that. They do a good job of keeping everything abstract to let you know the importance of the game. And for the life of me, I couldn't tell you what it was, you know, and I think that's how it was written. That was fun.
Yeah. Price?
I know we're talking about influential books. I don't quite know if this is it for me, but it is maybe the last very long book I've read in a while, which is Jonathan Franzen's Freedom. It is sort of the decades-long story of this family as they split apart and get back together and kind of deal with everyone's own baggage. I remember when I read it, I think it might have been in this like 1 week period between when I quit my last job and before I was moving out to Austin, and I just like read this over like a week straight. But I really enjoyed that.
Excellent. My pick, I'm just going to say that Richest Man in Babylon, you know, it's hokey in many ways, but the messages in there are very interesting. And, you know, it's a book that you talk to other people. I've encountered other people, read it, and, you know, took it to heart and go, yeah, it was just a really wonderful way of framing things. So I mean, you can get the Kindle version for like 99 cents. I'm sure a PDF is available. Audiobooks like $3. So there you go.
Right on.
It's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.